Some of you know that I really like ravens. And I'd like to tell you why I like ravens. Particularly, oh dear, let's see. Well, there we go. Particularly, well, there's a lot of things that I like about ravens, but particularly I like their call. And those birds that were cawing during Zazen were not ravens. Those were crows. You know, raven is the one that has a deeper kind of throaty croak. And ravens live high in the big trees around here. They fly a lot between the tops of the really big trees. And here's the thing about raven. I first kind of fell in love with ravens in the Mojave Desert in southern Death Valley in the mid-80s. I was there doing something that I've done several times. Some of you know this May I did again. A practice I have of going into wild places and fasting and being alone for several days, usually with a supported, you know, supported by a base camp, but with a group of people off, each doing our own fast. And so when I did my first one in the mid-80s, raven was everywhere. And I came to associate the sound of raven with that whole numinous experience that I had out there. I might talk a little bit about some of what happened out there. I learned a lot from wind. Raise your hand if you've ever been in a desert windstorm. I'm just curious. Some of you have. I learned a lot from the supposedly empty, big, vast night sky. There were lots of teachers for me there. And so it was the place where I first got turned on to the thought of investigating the Buddha Dharma. I had an experience there that brought me right to try to look for a Zen teacher. So it was pretty directly connected with my being a practitioner of Zen. And whenever I hear raven, I'm there. It's the most amazing thing. I don't know, maybe you have a sound or smell that you've experienced in your life that takes you there. It doesn't go through my mind even. It's just a direct body kind of heart presencing of the numinous world and the experience of, I believe, you know, the possibility that any time and anywhere we can wake up. And so what's really cool about ravens is that they're not just in the Mojave Desert, but they're everywhere. They're in the city, they're in the country, they're in my backyard, they're here. They really get around. So I never know when I'm going to hear that call. And it's such a treat when I hear it. It's like, you know, Kathy, are you awake? Are you awake? Am I awake? So I bring this up as an example of the subject of tonight's talk, which is how I believe that the other, what I call the other than human world, can be a tremendous support for our practice of awakening together with all beings. And I'll tell you why I think and why I'm encouraging this practice. But first I want to ground this proposition that I'm making to you in some teachings. And I want to go pre-Zen. Chuang Tzu was a Taoist master who was teaching in China. It said in the back 200 or 300 years before B.C., the 4th and 3rd centuries B.C. So, you know, Buddha was around B.C., I think. I'm not so good at the dates. And what? 500 B.C. Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then this was kind of, he was like almost a contemporary then. He was in China. They didn't know each other. Shakyamuni was in India. And Chuang Tzu is wandering around the mountains of China, right? Okay, good. Thank you for helping me with my not-so-good historical timeline memory. But anyhow, I feel it's highly appropriate in a Zen temple to bring forth a Taoist master because, as we know, Zen has its roots in Taoism. Zen, what we call Zen, Buddhism existed before Zen. Buddhism existed in China. But the particular flavor that we call Zen was when the Indian practitioners went to China and started to encounter the Taoist teachings. And that was what gave birth to what we call Zen. So here's one of our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers. And this poem is called The Breath of Nature, and it's a translation, actually interpretation by Thomas Merton, just to bring in a little bit more interfaith, one of the great Christian mystics. And this is a book where he translated and kind of did some liberal, like, interpretive translation here. It's not literal. It really comes from his spirit and his own deep experience as a mystic. And a person who probably spent a lot of time fasting alone in nature. So he resonated with grandfather Chang Su. So the breath of nature. When great nature sighs, we hear the winds which, noiseless in themselves, awaken voices from other beings blowing on them. From every opening, loud voices sound. Have you not heard this rush of tones? There stands the overhanging wood on the steep mountain, old trees with holes and cracks, like snouts, maws, and ears, like beam sockets, like goblets, grooves in the wood, hollows full of water. You hear mooing and roaring, whistling, shouts of command, grumblings, deep drones, sad flutes. One call awakens another in dialogue. Gentle winds sing timidly. Strong ones blast on without restraint. Then the wind dies down. The openings empty out their last sound. Have you not observed how all then trembles and subsides? You replied, I understand. The music of earth sings through a thousand holes. The music of man is made on flutes and instruments. What makes the music of heaven? Master Qi said, something is blowing on a thousand different holes. Some power stands behind all this and makes the sounds die down. What is this power? So that's a good question. Now, of course, it's almost like reading Dogen to read that. I mean, it's not so far from, Dogen, who says things like, because earth, grass, trees, walls, tiles, and pebbles all engage in Buddha activity, those who receive the benefit of wind and water caused by them are inconceivably helped by the Buddha's guidance, splendid and unthinkable, and awaken intimately to themselves. Not so different. And in fact, very often in our Zen stories, great nature is present, often perhaps as a setting for some of the enlightenment experiences that the ancestors have. You know, Dongshan attained enlightenment after he left his teacher, when he was crossing the river. And he saw his reflection in the river. So in this case, the river was supporting him in having his awakening experience. Or, the stories where, the monk practices for so many years and then she hears the sound of a pebble falling on a piece of bamboo and she has her awakening. So very often we have nature as a backdrop, we have nature as a metaphor, and that's fine, but I would actually like to go one step further tonight, if I may, and that is to suggest that it's not, great nature is not just a metaphor, and it's not just background, but we might actually think about it as the actual reality of our, the larger than human truth that is our life. that it's not background, it's actually foreground. And that if we can open our senses and our perception beyond the limitation of this skin bag, that it can be a profoundly supportive companion, guide, and teacher. And that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. I think there's three ways I thought about it. There's probably more, but I came up with three ways that I think that great nature helps us with our practice in awakening together with all beings. And I guess to be sort of professorial, I'll name those three ways and then I'll go back and explain each of them. I think the first way is that it's actually where we come from and who we are. So if we want to study the self and if we want to experience awakening with all beings, it's good to be directly connected with that which made us, that which is us. A second way is that I think great nature offers us pivotal moments and encounters a direct experience of suchness. And I also think it's, in my opinion, well, Sasheen is probably up there too, one of the really great ways to practice not knowing is to put yourself out there in where you can have contact with the other than human realm and support the practice of not knowing, which is a highly valued practice in Zen. So to go back and just talk a little bit about the statement I made that great nature is where we came from, who we are, I'd like to read a quote. This is by a person who, he studied Zen, but I don't think he identifies as a Buddhist at this stage. His name is Bill Plotkin, and he is an eco-psychologist, and he's the person who's been leading the program that I've been participating with this year. Some of you know I've been going off and doing these adventures. Well, he's the founder of the school that that practice comes from. And I think this is from his book called Soulcraft. He says, "What makes us human is not merely other humans. We evolved over millennia in response to the challenges and opportunities encountered within a wildly complex web of ecological relationships in a thoroughly animate world. The ways that we think, feel, experience, imagine, and act have arisen in attunement to the rhythms of the day and the turning of the seasons and in intimate relationship with myriad other life forms and forces." I'm actually going to read that one more time. It's rather dense, but I think it's not too hard to follow, so I'll read it one more time. "What makes us human is not merely other humans. We evolved over millennia in response to the challenges and opportunities encountered within a wildly complex web of ecological relationships in a thoroughly animate world. The ways that we think, feel, experience, imagine, and act have arisen in attunement to the rhythms of the day and the turning of the seasons and in intimate relationship with myriad other life forms and forces." So I'm suggesting that if indeed our practice is to awaken together with all beings, I think that a way to have that not be abstract is to actually experience it in our body with other beings, with the mountains, with the plants, with the animals, with the rocks, with the sky, with the ocean, with the waters. It doesn't have to be the big, huge adventure, though I highly recommend those, but it can be even just trying to find some blades of grass on the city street. Or it could be just putting yourself down on the earth wherever you are and knowing that even if there's a floor or even if there's pavement, that underneath that pavement and underneath that floor, you know what's there. You know, Mother Earth is there. I believe this is what the great teaching of Buddha touching the earth, the symbolic meaning of that for us. And not, no, let me correct myself, not symbolic. That was not symbolic. That was actually, he was actually, so here's the story. And you might already know it, but I'll tell it again because I love it. While he was doing his vision fast, is solo fast out in the wilderness sitting. I'm not going to get up until I have some insight about what is going on here. What is the root of suffering and what is the liberation of suffering? And he was tortured by his adversary Mara. And whether you want to believe mythologically that Mara was a real being or whether you want to imagine it was his projected fear and his self-doubt, you know, the negative voices that we have in our heads that tell us that we're not worthy people, he was being tormented in his fast. And hopefully I'll get to a part, I'll have enough time tonight to tell you about a little bit of my torment because it's kind of fun to talk about. But, you know, one of the things Mara said was, who do you think you are upon, you know, doing this? On what authority do you think that you can awaken? And what did he do? He touched the earth. With the earth as my witness. You know. Now, of course, we weren't really there. We don't know, did this really happen? But it doesn't matter because all of our stories, we weren't really there. So I love that story. And I believe it happened. And I believe Buddha touched the earth. And I believe the earth trembled in support of acclamation to Mara and said, you know, this person is worthy. This person has the capacity to wake up. So he received guidance and wisdom, you know, from the earth, from the morning star. They say that was the catalyst for his great awakening statement of I alone and all beings together are realizing the Buddha way. It was when he saw the rising of the morning star, when he saw Venus. So this is not just something that happens in the stories. This is something that can happen to us anytime. Set your alarm for 2 a.m. and go down to the beach. You know, take your deep question down there. No one's there. You could sit on a rock and you can literally talk out loud to the water and you can ask it your difficult questions. But then we have to listen. We have to get quiet and we have to listen because this response quality that I think that both Chuang Tzu and also Dogen are talking about, you know, when Dogen talks about how those who receive the benefit of wind and water are inconceivably helped by the good Buddha's guidance. We have to listen. We have to allow its teaching to come forward. So maybe you've had an experience where you've received some kind of teaching from great nature, and maybe during the discussion time we could talk a little bit about that. I'll talk a little bit about some that I've had, but I want to go on a little bit more right now and do another couple of points before I share personal experience. So I think the other way that great nature really can support our practice is by offering us these encounters, which can be these pivotal moments, the direct experience of suchness. And I have a few quotes. I want to read a few more quotes before sharing experience because I just think they're so helpful and so important. So Hakuin, who's one of the Rinzai ancestors, a close cousin to the Soto tradition. He wrote a fascicle, a piece that was called Seeing into One's Own Nature. And there's a phrase in this that I think is just extremely powerful. And I thank my Dharma sister Beata for pointing this out to me when I was sharing with her about the experience that I had in May out on Capitol Reef, which I keep promising I will talk a little bit about. But Hakuin said, when your activity of mind is exhausted, it's very important to exhaust our minds, and your capacity for feeling comes to a dead end, if something should take place, not unlike the cat springing upon the mouse or the mother hen hatching her eggs, then in a flash, great livingness surges up. When our minds are exhausted and we've even released our capacity for feeling and we're at a dead end, something might take place. Something like a cat springing on a mouse, something like a hen hatching her eggs. Absolute mystery outside of our human realm. We humans do not control the mice and the cats and the hens and the eggs. This is the other than human realm. Our teachers, if we let them. Hakuin says, this is the moment. This is the moment when, in a flash, great livingness surges up. The moment when the phoenix escapes from the golden net and when the crane breaks the bars of its cage. So this opportunity to encounter something that is bigger than us, something that was not created by our mind, I believe this is this direct experience of suchness that great nature is very, very good at helping us have these moments. Now, of course, the perception of it is the mind. We know this. The fact that we make stories about it and meaning, we attribute meaning, that's our mind, absolutely. And I'll completely take responsibility for all the meaning I've imbued into raven and hummingbird and wind and all of these, you know, stories that I tell about my own personal kind of awakening experiences. But the wind is not my mind. And I think this is a very, very important distinction to make. The perception, yes, but the thing itself, the thing that can surprise you, frighten you, and challenge you, and defeat you, and shake you to your core. You know, this is what I wish for you. It's kind of scary. But this is where I think we can really encounter suchness. I want to give you a few instructions, because the instructions that I got from the Animus program, I think are absolutely great instructions, and I don't want to be stingy with them. So I will read you a few instructions. So here's some instructions for wander onto the land and be in conversation with the beings of the place. Go out and talk with rock, tree, ocean, raven, wind. Drop your navigational strategies. Drop your oars and see where the winds and currents take you. Listen with your cells and the soles of your feet. Court the mystery. Wander in the world and find places where your sense of who you are trembles, where you feel destabilized, where you want to stop what you're doing, where questions arise that could make or unmake a life. So, a little bit of what that looked like for me in May was, I'm 62. And I don't know, something at least for me happened when I started to see the six in front of my name, and maybe others of you here who have passed that threshold have had that experience. It starts getting a little bit more like, oh no, really, don't waste time. Because all of a sudden you start kind of doing the math, and you know, you realize, I mean, even if I live to be 90, wow, that'd be great. That's less than 30 years. That's not very much time, especially to do all the things I still want to do. So, you know, you kind of start, I don't know, maybe it happens younger, but for me it really happened when I crossed that threshold into my 60s. And maybe it's also because it's a time in our life when often we've kind of done our whole middle-aged, you know, whether, you know, you raise children and maybe your children are older by the time you're 60, maybe they've left home, maybe you've already had now 30 years in a career, and maybe you're, you know, I mean, a lot of us have to keep working well into 70s or even 80s, but there's a kind of a different quality, at least I find, between when you're in your 20s or 30s and you're in your 40s and you're creating something, and when you're more on the side of just, I don't know. I mean, for me, what it really has been is really kind of an assessment of what is it that I really want to be doing with my life energy. You know, what is my purpose in the sense of very specifically, what do I want to wake up and do with my day and not just be presuming that it has to necessarily be what I've been doing up until now. So I went to this most recent fast in May with that question of, please give me guidance, mystery, in terms of anything that you can help me with here to learn to get some guidance just in where to really focus my energy. And one of the things I really like about this Animus program is that they really do a lot of preparatory work where for months and months and months we were encouraged to really just let go of who you think you are, really just try to get out of as many commitments as you can, really not know. Really try to allow yourself to not know who you are. Of course, you have to fulfill your responsibilities. It's not about becoming irresponsible, but wherever you can. They encouraged us to do media fasts. Don't read the news. Don't click on, you know, the political things. So hard not to do that. I'm doing it again. But, you know, there was a period where I was allowing myself to not do that. Anyhow, so that when we would get out there, we would really be as empty as possible to be able to go out and to be alone, to be fasting, and to really pray and ask for support from the mystery. And I also, it's not, you know, the practice of going out and fasting is something that happens in cultures throughout the world. I mean, Shakyamuni Buddha did that. That's where our Buddha's teaching came from, was from his own version of a fast in nature. But certainly on this continent, the Native American cultures, especially the Plains people, the Lakota in particular, had a very, very strong, still have a very, very strong tradition of the vision fast. And it's interesting because, you know, it's often translated as vision quest. And the term in the Lakota language, Hanblacheya, which the white anthropologists and travelers and the people who are out, you know, observing the cultures, they called it vision quest. But that's not what it means. It does not mean vision quest. It means lament. It means lament. It means go out humble and strip down and say, I can't do this. I don't know what to do. I need your support. Please help me. Grandmother, grandfather, please help me. So I took that to heart, and I decided I was, as much as I could, I was going to allow myself to practice this approach of coming from a place of humility and lament that I really, really needed guidance in how to best serve my people, and I was open to receiving that guidance. And I did a lot of personal rituals and stuff. But, of course, I'm me. So I still secretly hoped that it was going to come riding on chariots out of the sky and be given to me on a silver platter, and it was going to be really clear. I was going to get like the sacred book, right, like Moses or somebody, you know. Oh, this is what to do. Here, this is what to do. I confess that I have this sort of mind. And I thought, well, if I'm really, really good and I really do everything just right, that's going to happen, isn't it? And it didn't. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. It was very valuable. It was great. But I was, my second night, you know, we had three nights solo. My second night, you know, I had everything just right, and I put out my rocks, and I sat in the middle of my rock circle, and I drummed, and I prayed, and it's like, oh, tonight, please, I want you to help me have clarity, and tell me what I need to know tonight, you know. the night goes on, the night goes on, and you know how those, the night is there, you know, the stars just really slowly, you know, you watch the stars just really slowly crossing, really slowly, it's really dark, it's really quiet, nothing, nothing, no guidance. And I started to get really worried. Uh-oh. I have this feeling of being defeated. I'm so sad. This is from my journal. I'm so sad about how other people are so clear about their purposes. And even though I have a passionate burning desire inside me to express and give and bring joy to others, I don't have a name for what my purpose is. I feel like such a failure. I had hoped I would get some kind of a holy seed that would give me guidance, but this truly is ego's last stand. I'm going to go down the hill again, an empty-handed raven. Without clarity, it makes me feel so sad and so scared. Now, I'm going to tell the story, and the experience definitely shifted, and I felt by the time I walked down from the mountain that I was given a tremendous gift. But what I really want to highlight is that this experience of letting ourselves be broken is so powerful, and I think that it's a beautiful part of the Zen tradition. And people often are afraid of Zen, and they don't like Zen because it's too hard. You know, I want to do that easier kind of meditation. I want to do the meditation where, you know, it's just softer and nicer and easier. And Zen, that sort of relentless, where you do get to these places where you feel the pain and it hurts. And I'm not saying pain is awakening. I mean, I hate pain. I do. I always struggle with this part of Zen. But this kind of experience, it's so unusual to be able to let ourselves have it. And so often it comes from, we get it when we have bad things happen to us. We get in an accident, or we get sick, or our lover dies, or leaves us and goes off with another. You know, we have these experiences, and they're so difficult. But could we actually sometimes even open to and invite it to happen so that something can happen that's outside of our cognitive control, that's outside of the map that we make that of what we think the world is about? Shohaku Okamura says, "We create a copy of reality to guide our minds, even though we still continue living in absolute reality beyond thought. Our thoughts about reality are like an atlas of the earth. It shows us a likeness, but it can't perfectly represent the earth because it is two-dimensional and the world is three-dimensional. Our basic delusion is that we take it for granted that the fabricated picture of the world in our minds is the world itself." So what I'm suggesting is that if we can get ourselves to these places where truly our thoughts about who we are and our hopes and our expectations, where they're gone, there's actually then the possibility that something can happen that's a surprise. That's the unknown, that's not knowing. So what happened to little old me up there? Okay, so middle of the night, defeated, depressed, I had to pee. So I got up to pee, and I went and I did it. And I was very disoriented. I mean, you know, this is my fourth day of fasting, and it's dark, and I'm depressed. So I'm coming back, and I start to fall. And I'm, no, don't fall, don't fall. So I reached out, and I grabbed a bush, and it was a... It was like a thistle bush. And right? So I get back in my little circle, and I look down with my headlamp, and I see blood all over my sleeping bag. So now not only am I depressed and alone and not going to have my vision, but I'm bleeding all over my sleeping bag. So, I mean, I really, 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 really just lost it. And I had this feeling of, okay, I give up. I surrender. I'm even bleeding on you, Earth. You know, I give up. I it's just not going to happen. So, oh well. I'll just lie here and just look at the big old empty sky and see what happens in the morning. But what I realized then, actually it's not really empty, there's all the stars. And I had this feeling of affection. I called them the star people. Oh, the star people are winking down at me. I'm not really alone. You know, I am an interconnected child of the universe, even though I'm frustrated. So I went to sleep. And then in the morning, when I woke up, you know, the sunrise in the desert, or it's not really the desert, the high desert, so beautiful. You know, it's really dark, and then all of a sudden there's that moment where it starts getting light. And so then, you know, this like multi-hour experience of the sky slowly getting light and the sun coming up. So I'm sitting there, just sitting. Just sitting, not knowing. And I feel this buzzing and like on my head and this loud sound, and I felt this like sharp thing on my head, and it was a hummingbird dive bombing me. Ah, you know, dive bombing me. So I like brushed it away, and then I went, oh my God. Now, okay, you can tell me this is all delusion, you know, it's my mind, I'm making it up. But I took it as a sacred encounter. Hummingbird was coming and was blessing me and was saying, it's okay, you know, it's okay. So I felt so encouraged by hummingbird. And so then I went out into the day, and one thing that I had decided to do was I had decided to ask friends if they had prayers that they wanted me to offer for them in this setting. And so I had a pile of things that friends and family had written of requests that they were making for prayers. So I sat and I began to read and speak these prayers. And I'll just read you a few of them. These were some of the things that people asked for. That the great suffering and delight teaching spread out across the land. That fearful ego finally retire and let the brave self come forward to offer gifts to the world. That there be more kindness in the world. That people suffering from anger and fear and overwork find a place inside themselves to feel kindness. That my nephew, who is facing charges for his revolutionary activity in Puerto Rico because he loves the motherland, find a way to express himself in a way that he does not get in trouble. And on it went. And as I was making these petitions and reading these statements, I just started to sob. It was so interesting because I was so moved, first of all, that these were the things that people were asking me to pray for. I was very in touch with the feeling of the suffering of the world, the suffering of Puerto Rico, the suffering of people with physical pain and mental pain, the suffering of anger, fear, and overwork that's leading to this horrible, divisive environment that we have right now going on in our country. I felt the pain of that, but I also just felt this tremendous joy that I could feel the pain. And a joy that this is what people were asking for. And I felt that this is what we can do. This is what we can do, is connect with each other in our hearts and do our very, very best to nourish our heart connection and to serve the world and try to help relieve the suffering of the world. And I just realized in the deepest part of my being, I did not need any further clarity about my purpose. But that's always what I've wanted to do. That's always what's brought me the greatest joy. And it was so simple. It is simple. It's very simple. Phaon was going out on pilgrimage, Dijong said, "Where are you going?" Phaon said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dijong said, "What's the purpose of pilgrimage?" Phaon said, "I don't know." And Dijong said, "Not knowing is most intimate." So let's support each other in our practice in not knowing and being surprised and praying together for the relief of suffering in our world and nourishing our heart connection. So I think at this point I'll stop talking and see if there's anybody who wants to say anything. Thank you so much for listening and being present with this offering. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk.
Yes.
I really want to ask an old question I have, but I'd like you to pretend that you didn't answer it with the comments about not knowing.
Okay, I'll pretend.
Thank you. If I think that the sound of the wind blowing through the thousand holes contains some meaning or clarity for me, then I have some options. Either I think I've imbued that meaning myself, and it's just another story, another delusion, and I'm not interested in the helpful ones any more than I'm interested in the unhelpful ones. Or everything I think is outside is actually in my mind. Or the universe revolves around me. So these are the options about what to think about this experience. And none of them are that attractive to me.
Mm-hmm. So you said you had an old question?
That's my question. So what should I think? What should I... Should I imbue that meaning?
No, don't believe it. Don't imbue meaning. Don't do that. Now what?
Yeah. I mean, could easily say that, but then no hummingbird, no revelation.
Yeah.
No talk.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we all make our own way. And I will confess that, you know, I am one who loves to engage with the animate, you know, with imagination. And so that's my orientation. But I think that it's a very personal thing. And it's not for everybody. You know, the point for me is about hummingbird, what was so powerful about that, and why, like, I can make the story up about what I think hummingbird was and all that, but the hummingbird, I, this skin bag, did not control that being coming and dive bombing my head. So that was the encounter. Now, what I do with that, that's my delusion. Right? But the fact of it, to me, there's a liberating quality to that fact that we can open to body and heart and spirit experiences with great nature. I find it helpful. I find it nourishing. To me, it would be like so dismal to not have that in my life that I don't know if I could do what I do and carry on. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's nourishment. The same as Sangha is for me, you know, and some people, they want to go sit alone in the forest and do their practice. Good for you. I would go crazy if that's all I did. So, you know, we have to be our, you know, not, but I don't think we should do things that aren't, that don't, that, that feel, I don't know if it's not helpful. And ultimately, you'll never know if it's delusion or not, you know? I mean, there's no final, you know, St. Peter at the Holy Gate saying, Rachel, that was delusionary, that was truth, you know? I don't think.
That's what I was counting on.
Well, give it up, girlfriend. Give it up. Thank you. Yeah, Stan.
Joyce and I love walking down the river and seeing the flowers, and just they just sometimes just jump right out at you. Some right in front of a bank, and they keep changing. But this one blue heron seems to have this little spot. You can see from Soquel Bridge between that and the crossover bridge. And it's just wonderful to see him doing his thing, just standing there. Well, last night he was actually sleeping. But and there's so much of that, right? In downtown Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And there's beautiful trees and flowers. And
yeah, we're very, very fortunate.
Just opening up, it's just such a wonderful experience each and every time. Regardless of the weather. But everyone can find their own. I mean, probably in your backyard, wherever.
Great.
Just taking the time to...
Lenore, did I see your hand?
Yeah. I totally identify with your experience with the desert, and if you've ever been in the desert when the wind wasn't blowing, I heard silence for the first time. Mm-hmm. Also heard silence on a beach the other day when I was back just a little, and between the waves crashing, there's a moment of silence before the next one, and you can listen. And in between those, maybe not if you're right down by the shore, but just over the little place where people are actually. And there's the silence. And I experience this, I think I found out in Zazen how much my mind clutters up this beautiful space. And there's no way to let anything else in because of the stories. My story, I clutter up any empty space with a story. All the time, and on a cushion. Except when I have, like you said, come to the end, come to the, I'm back to myself. I'm like you, all that stuff happens, and then one more. And it occurred to me in my recovery from alcoholism, I had to learn what it was to hit bottom and to have to let go. And I had to learn that grasping at personal relationships in the process of that recovery. And I had to come to a point where I saw that I'm not running this. I don't know any better way to put it, but there comes a point, and there has to come a point, of this utter, I don't know what to call it, but it's a space where something might come in.
Yeah.
And to be able to be desperate enough to let that happen in the warm embrace of a fellowship of people that are doing the same thing. So you know you're not doing something kooky here.
Yeah.
I need to be kind of backed up by the reality that comes from feedback to others practicing the program.
Yes.
And just so I don't walk off into some kind of crazy notion of mine, you know, here comes another ocean and I just fly with it.
Yes.
That's not where I want to go. I need, in order to be empty, I have to practice with other people to be safe.
Yes.
But the opportunity to do that has, in my view, and, you know, years came at 62, maybe. I think mine came with last year's diagnosis of stage 4 endometrial. That means metastasized cancer.
Yeah.
I'm going tomorrow, and he's going to let me know how the treatment's been doing it, if it's been doing anything, and where we go from here.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I'm very bad at waiting for the other shoe to drop. But since I know that's out of my hands, you know, and I know what is in my hands.
Yes.
I've been walking on the beach and going to a gym. And I feel fantastic, especially once I've worked up a few endorphins like that. I'll take that. I'll take that bit of chemistry on my body.
Thank you, endorphins.
I need that in order to keep my head somewhat empty.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So anyway, here we are, and I learned how desperate it was to practice it. In the hospital, I said, "Wait a minute! I was going to outdo my grandmother who died at 96, my mother who died 6 weeks short of 99, and I looked like both of them. You know, I was going to outdo them, and all of a sudden, hold it there."
Yeah.
It begins not to look like, but I'm supposed to save all beings. I took a vow to save all beings, and I haven't hardly fairly started to even understand what that might mean. Maybe not thinking of myself all the time, for starters. But so, we're going to cut this off short. But, you know, there are times where, just let go, let it just, you know, let's just die and get it over with. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't do that because I made this pound of single being. So that's not my decision. There's a lot of stuff that's not up to me. How liberating is that?
Beautiful. Thank you for your teaching right now. Just thank you so much. Thank you for being here and bringing your experience. It makes me think of, I think it's time to stop. I'm going to read one closing quote, if I have it. I hope I brought it. Did I? Oh, you know, in all my notes that I was cutting. Oh, well, I didn't bring it. It was about not knowing. So we'll just stop with that. Not knowing is most intimate. And we can continue talking outside if we want. And also, I just want to put in a plug that I probably already said it, but I'll say it again. In my experience, the kind of equivalent great practice field for this kind of practice, other than going out into great nature, is Sesshin. And I know that that's a real, real, real special opportunity that we have, that in this temple we offer many, many Sesshins. And if you haven't done one for a while, or if you've never done one, or if you know that you love to do them, please consider. Because, as Lenore said, it's supported by the community. So you're alone on your cushion, and you're having some of these kinds of experiences of feeling your ego break down, and feeling that kind of desperate place, and also feeling this beautiful opening that can happen and this letting go. But you're supported by the community, by the sitting of the community, by the food that's brought in. So it's a really, really, I think it's a really great practice for this kind of thing too. So thank you so much again for your attention to this evening. Beings are numberless. Them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.